They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Radio Fairfax, and sitting across the table from me, across the board from me, I have my old friend John Cowherd again. John is, for those of you who have not met John yet, John's an attorney, a local attorney, who switched his practice, and he now represents homeowners. Not that he ever represented associations, but he does represent homeowners, and he's a rare breed there. And he also has a blog that a lot of people follow. And we're going to start with his blog. But first, John, thank you so much for coming in and joining me here in our wonderful studio at FPA.
Thank you, Sue. It's always wonderful to come on and to chat with you. And your show is really one of a kind, and it's a privilege and honor to be a part of it.
John, I started off with talking about your blog. It's called Words of Conveyance, right?
Right, that's correct.
And a lot of people are following that because you've written a lot about HOAs, and so it's a really great blog. And your latest post was kind of interesting. I want you to talk a little bit about it. I want you to tell us a little bit about it.
My latest post is I like to pull things from current events. I like to see what people are interested in that has to do with real estate, construction, community associations. It just so happens that there's a gentleman who's been getting quite a bit of media attention lately, Mr. Donald Trump, who's made, before he became a reality TV show star and a candidate, he was his claim to fame was building and selling condominium units all over the country and other real estate investments. And knowing that about him and figuring that he probably had some lawsuits that he's been involved in over the years, I thought I would kind of look up to see whether he's been in any cases that have been about community associations and have been about some of these core controversies about boards of directors and sales, initial sales of units, and these relationships between owners, associations, property managers, developers, declarants, and these relationships, which sometimes can work out well, and when they become toxic, they become toxic. And so I discovered that a few years ago, there was a major litigation out in Chicago area involving Mr. Trump that really had a story that I found to be very interesting. There was a CPA named Jacqueline Goldberg, who was a seasoned real estate investor, not someone who is just buying her first condominium unit, who found out that the Chicago Trump Tower was selling hotel condominium units. And hotel condominium units are something that are a little different than your typical residential unit. And hotel condominium, of course, the purchaser can live in it like a apartment, or they can allow the property management company to rent it out like a hotel room, rather than the owner renting it out like a, through a property management company like an apartment. So it's something a little, you know, most investors aren't becoming involved in this, but Ms. Goldberg was attracted to this investment. And, you know, the Trump Tower is not a little low-rise building. There's 486 residential units and 339 hotel condominium units. So it's quite a development. And then there's, of course, all the hotel amenities and so on. So in 2006, she signed two contracts to purchase two of these hotel units as investments. And one of them cost well over $1 million, and the other one a little less than $1 million. So she's really making quite an investment. And of course, I'm sure that when she purchased this, there was quite a bit of glossy literature that was provided to her about talking about all the ballrooms and the 30-foot ceilings and the health club and the concierge and so on and so forth. Included in this package was a statement that a lot of these amenities, like the health club and the ballrooms and so on, were a part of the common areas of the association. So one of the privileges of owning in this development was not only that you had your unit, but that you were a part owner of all of these hotel amenities, so that if someone wanted to join the health club, or they wanted to, or use it, or they wanted a ballroom for a big convention or something like that, that, you know, you'd have an ownership interest in those kinds of activities. And so that was a part of the selling points of this development. And then another item that was included in the package was, there was a very interesting phrase in the contract, which provided that the seller, which would have been the Trump Organization-controlled entity, reserved the right in its sole and absolute discretion to modify the condominium documents. And of course, the condominium documents include all the covenants, rules, regulations, and declarations, yeah, and bylaws that are really the you know, as they say, the contract that everyone buys into. So you can see that this is really a remarkable situation, where you have an investor who's purchasing about $2 million worth of hotel condominium units, and she's signed over the right to the developer to kind of switch out at their own discretion what remains a common area and what can be taken back by the developer to be privately owned by the Trump Organization entity. So that's quite there's a lot of trust and confidence that was posed by this investor in this developer that I think that you really have to have a lot of either have to have a high risk tolerance for risk, or to just have a lot of confidence in this development in order to make that kind of investment. Shu, what do you think about those kinds of clauses in purchase contracts?
Well, I am a firm believer that if you buy something, you own it. But when you're in a condominium where everybody owns everything, it would seem to me, if you have amenities there that presumably you can use. I'm guessing, right, that she could use them. But then her house is not, her unit is not going to be held hostage to make sure that somebody who has absolutely zero experience in running something huge like that is going to make a go of it. I mean, we see so many failures across the country in condominiums because they're not funded properly. They don't know what they're doing. People are having to come up with huge special assessments to cover shortfalls and things like that. And on the plus side, I would think, hey, you know, as long as I can use that stuff, if it's there for a fee, it's probably cheaper in the long run to belong to it and let someone else fix the leaks. And I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's there's a number of different observations I would make about this clause. On the one hand, it just makes me uncomfortable if someone comes into my office and says, what do you think about this contract that I'm thinking about entering in? And I would have to explain to them that really the seller can take away part of what you're paying for at any time just by the stroke of a pen, that they can take that away. And that's something that's giving the other side the unilateral ability to change the terms of the deal, which I would feel uncomfortable with. But maybe you've just touched on something that made me think that there's another angle to this. That's, what would you rather have? Who would you rather have own these hotel elements? Would you rather have an association with all the governance problems of the association running a hotel operation by its own property management apparatus? Or would you rather just completely give up those common areas, your interest in those common areas, and have it run by the Donald Trump real estate empire or by some third party? And maybe that would actually lower costs or lower your potential liabilities for assessments. That's an angle on this that I hadn't considered.
You know what? You know, let's talk about the ownership, because correct me if I'm wrong, when you buy a condominium, when you buy a unit, you're actually buying airspace, right? You're just buying whatever's inside that, and then all the members collectively own the building. And so if something goes wrong, everybody's on the hook for repairing and fixing that, right? The roof springs a leak even though you're way at the bottom, and you're not going to get any water damage from that leak if somebody's on the top floor, but yet you're going to have to pay for that. If someone else owns that and someone else is responsible for that, you still have your unit. If you want to use the pool, can you just belong to the pool, pay a membership? And if you no longer want to belong to the pool, you stop paying for it. Unlike in an HOA, in a condominium, forced condominium, you're going to have to pay for that forever.
Well, it's interesting that you raised that issue, because for 9 years I owned a residential condominium unit in Alexandria. And during some of the darker points in this real estate, recession, there was discussions in the annual meeting about whether the pool should simply be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
The lower doors should be locked, the water should be drained out, tarp should be drawn over it, because it's an expense that has to be borne by the members and do you want to vote to raise your assessments, or do you want to close the pool? That's a business decision that's made by the board of directors. And I suppose the same could be said for things like the health club. If you have a kind of a fancy health club or some catering operation or restaurant or something like that inside of a hotel condominium unit, but then I think it, and I think that the decision that was made, if I remember it correctly, in the association that I was a member of, was that you really needed to have the pool to be open, because having the pool closed is kind of like raising the white flag. It's raising the white flag as far as the resale values of units. It's sending a signal to people that things are really kind of going south, and you kind of need to keep morale high within the building. Otherwise, people start to, the whole property values discussion that's kind of abused in some other context. But I think that was the decision that was made, but is to keep it open for those kinds of reasons. But if you're dealing with a hotel condominium unit, or any kind of common area that's something that you could charge a fee for, like a pool or a health club or a restaurant or any of these things, you could end up with a situation where that amenity is so small or uninteresting to a business that no one would want to own that element of the development. And it might end up going dark because of the difficulties of finding someone to rent it or to buy that part of the community property. So it seems to be a more complicated question. I think that in this case, and this to kind of bring us back to the Chicago Trump Tower, that this is a kind of a more complicated condominium setup where at least the Trump Organization took the position that there needed to be a kind of a central creative control over it to keep it good for everyone, and that was the position that they took in this case. What ended up happening was Ms. Goldberg signed those contracts. She put down $516,000 in earnest money deposits. And then later, she learned that the developer changed the declaration to take out the health club, the concierge, the laundry, and the meeting rooms, ballrooms, and the executive lounge from the common areas. And when that happened, the buyer, immediately thought, I've been schnookered. I've been baited and switched, and there's no way that I'm going to go through on this purchase. I want my money back. I don't want to. Those were terms of the deal that I thought I was going to get those, have ownership rights in those common areas, and where's my $516,000? And that's kind of what brought that case into being, was this the sense that she had been had by this developer.
Before we go on, I don't know anything about the ownership of hotel units in a condominium. I know what condominiums are like, and I know what the ownership is, but when you take a number of those and you say, all right, these are hotel units, these are hotel condominiums, what exactly is the ownership there? Is it the same ownership that you have if it were just a plain condominium?
The case opinion doesn't go into a tremendous amount of detail about how exactly what the technical differences were between the
legal differences between the two.
But I imagine that this was the kind of thing where you walk into the hotel and you go up to the concierge and you say, I want a room for the evening. And this is not like Airbnb or one of these other VRBO. I'm not sure if I've got my acronyms correct, but this is not that kind of condominium rental setup, that this looks and feels like a hotel to a guest, but behind the scenes, the hotel hotel rooms are owned by these investors, which is a lot different. I mean, at least until the Airbnb business type of model has arisen, was would be considered very unusual and something that you wouldn't find in places like, you know, Manassas, Virginia, or Fairfax, or something like that. You really would need to find some very swank downtown area where real estate is really at a premium, and this kind of ownership structure would be attractive to the public.
And this raises another question for me. When you read a lot of the stuff that's written about condominiums and associations, they don't want rentals because renters bring down property values. And especially if you're going to have a renter, they certainly don't want short-term rentals because then you're going to have people in and out and in and out, and they want something sturdy. But yet this is a top scale condominium or a building here that relies on having people come in for short term. I mean, a significant portion of the entire building is turned over to short term rentals, if that's what you want to do with it.
Right.
Unless
right.
you want to live in it, but
right.
I don't know if you do. So does it devalue property, or is this going to keep values up? It seems to me that there are a lot of contradictions in the HOA, condominium, common ownership, interest, well, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, some economists have come to the conclusion that people who live in real estate are more likely to make their mortgage payments than people who are just renting them out to other people. That's the model that the federal government, that's the belief that the federal government has taken as a policy as far as all of these federally subsidized mortgages. So whether it's true or false, it's policy. So it's kind of the part of the lay of the land.
It's just excuses.
Landscape. I mean, I think it probably depends on the development, its location, the market. It's these policies, I think, are in part a reaction to the uncertainty of where a particular development may be going as far as whether people want to own or rent from it. And nobody really knows what's going to happen. These investments aren't, there's no.
I think so much of it is the fear factor and the manipulation, because I've watched over the years, because I've been doing this for a long time, John. I've been watching this market and I've been watching this phenomenon for a long time, and they keep bouncing back and forth. There's nothing conclusive. There's no conclusive evidence that this is the way it is. All of a sudden, it's like, oh my goodness, we can't do this. This is bad. It's going to devalue property, and everybody starts repeating it, whether there's any truth to that or not. And so I'm kind of glad that this is coming up, because it shows that maybe we're not asking the right questions. Maybe we're not looking at things factually. Maybe we're missing something really, really big somewhere along the line.
Right. Well, it is becoming a big question because of the whole Airbnb and other Craigslist opportunities that are out there. And I think that it's something that associations are starting to grapple with, whether, you know, even if you aren't a hotel condominium, what if you've got a substantial or not substantial number of owners who want to run their unit like a hotel or a condominium unit and have different people in there at different times, and what is the an issue with that. I know that that from a real estate law standpoint, that there's a big difference between being a tenant and being a hotel guest.
Yeah.
That it's as a tenant, you know, the old-fashioned way of looking at a tenant is that you're someone who has something like a deed. You're like an owner of the property, but that deed only lasts for a certain period of time. And so you've got, you know, sometimes you might see documents described as deed of lease. So that's the old-fashioned way of looking at real estate rental. I mean, the modern view and the view that's taken and you most experience as a tenant is that they view a rental agreement for real estate as much more like any other commodity, like renting a car or renting farm equipment, or it's like any other commercial contract. And then when you're dealing with hotel space, you know, if you are a hotel and you overstay and you don't pay your bill, you trash the unit or what have you, the hotel does not have to go to court and get an eviction proceeding to get rid of you. All they, you know, they have more urgent ways of getting people out of the building that don't take 6 weeks or 6 months to evict them. And of course, there are gray areas between renting and hoteling, but those are the kinds of things that, you know, are factual issues that can be threshed out. Exactly where that puts us as far as all these changes that are going on in the real estate world, you know, I don't know, but it certainly is an interesting time to kind of be watching it all.
Because I've been watching it, and I think we've really screwed up drastically in residential America, and I think we continue to do that without asking the right questions and without trying to figure out what the real problem is instead of just going off creating more. And over the years, I've watched this create more and more problems, and it's always the housing consumer, the homeowner, who tends to get the short end of the stick.
I mean, the question that I like to ask in a lot of these situations is, what's wrong with freedom?
Right.
You know, I mean,
I like that question.
I mean, is there something about the situation where freedom is a problem? Where freedom's a real problem and not a made-up problem, like that owners can't figure out how to maximize their own property values, or that, you know, if you leave your trash cans out for 6 hours beyond a certain time period, that you've ruined people's scenic easements or something like that. I mean, those are not really big picture issues, but it's I would tend to agree with you that ownership should mean what we think it means, and the normal indicia of ownership, and not just a word that's used to separate people from their money.
Yeah. You know, going back to your original question, what do I think of that? I really am not fond of the idea that somebody can unilaterally change the provisions of a contract, as in this case. But that's consistent with what CAI will tell you. Well, you agreed to this, didn't you? It was in writing. So no, I think that if you're a party to a contract and somebody wants to change it, I think everybody, not 70% or 60% or 51%, should be able to change that. But that's what's happening now. But in that case, it's unilateral. I mean, it was Trump who could do that.
Right. Well, I mean, the case that the purchaser brought was based on this theory that the developer never intended to keep those hotel common elements in the development, and that they were just a part of the sales technique, and that they intended all along to remove them out and to deprive her of this property after having sold it, however small of an interest she had in it. And then in defense, Mr. Trump said some very interesting things. Their defense was that including these things in the common elements of the condominium was a mistake. It was either a clerical error, a typographical error, or somebody further down on the decision tree, the hierarchy, had put these things in as common areas, and the sale started to take place before the more seasoned and experienced and knowledgeable people were able to figure out what was happening, and that these things needed to be moved out because otherwise you would have an owner's association, a condominium board of directors that have been elected by its members, who would be in charge of running a hotel. You know, we've talked a lot on the show about the horror stories about boards of directors, but imagine if they were running a hotel operation, a luxury hotel, and that's kind of the gist of Mr. Trump's testimony. As quoted in this court opinion, he stated that it was difficult for a board of directors to manage these kinds of amenities like rooms, ballrooms, food and beverage operations, and that in his experience that condominium associations can kind of change their mind in all sorts of different ways, and fire property managers and rehire other ones, and really, in his words, do lots of different things to create tremendous turmoil and really ruin the operation very easily. And that if the association fired a manager that was really needed to be there, it could become a disaster for the development. And I thought this was a very interesting comment because, Mr. Trump obviously has a tremendous amount of experience in condominium developments, and to speak so frankly about the weaknesses of the board of directors governance model and how those weaknesses could manifest themselves in a complex development where you've got a hotel operation superimposed over the condominium model. I think it speaks a lot about not only about that type of operation, but about your more ordinary condominiums where maybe they're not managing a luxury hotel, but there's a parking lot, and if you have a parking lot, someone's managing that. Someone's issuing parking permits. Someone's hiring and firing the person who's in charge of the tow truck. And if you can't get to your condominium unit because of some mismanagement of the parking lot or the way that parking privileges are being managed or manipulated or mismanaged, then if you can't get to it, the property isn't worth much, right? Its value goes down to near to zero. So I think that this his comments are ones that I think that have been repeated, have been the general sentiment of his comments have been things that have been talked about on this show and elsewhere for quite a few years, but I think coming from him, of course, they are things that are said, that are testified to in litigation, and as we both know, that when you're in litigation, you kind of a lot of things are said for all sorts of different reasons, but I think that there's he did win this trial against this purchaser, and You know, it's it may, I don't know what was going on in the mind of the jury, but it may have been that this or some similar testimony may have rang true with some of them.
Well, with all the condominiums you have out there and all the horror stories, and you've either been in a condominium where you've run into that sort of thing, or you have a relative or a friend, or you've read about it, so you know that this happens all too often. But I want to go back to what you asked your question earlier about what's wrong with freedom. And I know that condominiums and HOAs are different animals, so I'm going to put condominiums aside right now because it doesn't pertain to that. But when you look at an HOA where you actually have fee simple ownership in a house, and then you attach all of these amenities, and then you can place a lien on the individual private homes to make a go of these things, and that's where you run into all kinds of problems. I've long advocated for having real private companies come in and own all of the amenities. Off the Deep End can own the pools, and if you want to join the pool, you join the pool, and if they want to run it into the ground, it's not going to cost you your home.
Well, it would be a lot simpler to simply not to simply have the pool to be completely independently owned, and
that's what I'm saying,
and to not even be a figure anywhere in the structure of the condominium or the HOA, wouldn't it? I mean, it would.
That's what I'm saying. It's just, you know, separate all this out. They go, oh well, if you don't have an HOA, who's going to take care of the common areas? Well, don't have common areas. Have those common areas privately owned by a company whose job it is, they make money. It's just like, if you don't go to work, you're not going to make money, right? If you own a pool and you mismanage it and mishandle it, you're going to lose what you have. So you're more likely to really do a good job of maintaining that and taking care of it and making good business decisions, as opposed to just, letting someone come in and no adult supervision anywhere. You just let it go.
Or even better, have two pools and have them compete with each other, and whichever pool is,
you can do whatever
is
you
running
want.
A bit better, is providing a better pool at a better price, you know, gets more visitors, and there you go. I mean, it's I know that it's, I think that what we're seeing in a lot of the way that these things are promoted is that people are genuinely hungry for a sense of community, that they genuinely that's on some level, maybe not from their HOA, but that's that people want that. That's, you know, when you buy a house, you want to be a part of some kind of community, whether it's that neighborhood or something. People who buy houses are people who are making commitments to be in a specific place for a long-term period, and I think that desire is something that's noble, and you want to be surrounded by people who want to be a part of a community, but you don't have to have a common interest community in order to have a real community, whether it's a community like a neighborhood, or whether it's something less geographic and it's like a club or a religious organization or a workplace or something like that, I think that in some situations, this kind of noble and very basic human desire to be in a community is a part of the sales process, you know, for better or for worse.
The fact is that HOAs have killed any sense of community, because now in a community, everybody's on the same level. There's a commonality between you, but in an HOA, there isn't. There's a hierarchy. You've got board members who have powers over you, who can do things, who are watching over you to make sure that you're not breaking the rules, because if you leave that garage door open for more than 12 minutes instead of the 10 minutes you're allowed, you're going to bring down my property values. So I'm going to go after you and I'm going to fine you. That kills it. People don't trust each other in an HOA. I mean, I hear from people, there's that, I don't know, there's that antagonism. I mean, neighbors at war is exactly right. Neighbors at war. We've got about 15 minutes left, John, and I want to go to, what is it? You know, we've been talking about HOAs, and in a sense, we've been talking about what people get. Are Americans or American housing consumers getting what they're buying or what they think they're buying? Or are we running into all kinds of problems? I know that we've talked about construction defects. We've talked about warranties in the past. And I know that we have all of these issues that are coming up, and you've been dealing with warranties as well.
Well, the construction warranty kind of gets back to this, what we were just speaking about the sales process in the purchase of a home. I mean, a lot of people buy what you, for lack of a better word, used homes or pre-used homes, but also people are buying new properties that are either kind of a cookie cutter type of house that's very similar to its neighboring properties, mm-hmm. or it could be a completely custom home built from a set of plans made to order, or it could be some kind of something in between where you get some options that you can, some add-ons that you can purchase. Many people are attracted to going to different builders because I know a lot of promises are made. You know, representations are made about their experience, different warranty packages that are provided, all sorts of different representations are made about what they're getting when they purchase the property. And then as they get into the whole process, many buyers find out that there are many perils to buying a new built home that they had no idea that they would ever have to deal with. That, as one of your other guests, I think Tyler Birding.
Tyler Birding, yeah.
Tyler Birding was talking about early on in the housing crisis, a lot of builders just went out of business, and you only had a few people that were able to survive through into this stage that we're at in the housing crisis. And now that new construction is starting to come back, you've got a lot of people that are either getting back in the business or expanding their operations, and they're bringing on a lot of inexperienced workers, or they're cutting corners because of costs and things like that. And as Tyler Birding mentioned, unfortunately, a lot of the quality control is not being done by the local government permitting office or by the companies themselves. Is being done by attorneys, because there's just it's becoming such a crisis in the way that homes are being sold with so many defects now. And really what's happening is that a tremendous burden is being placed on purchasers to figure out what it is that they're buying. And we're not talking about like rights here. We're talking about, well, is the garage door put on properly, or is the roof is the roof waterproof? Basic questions like that. Or is there going to be flooding in the basement? So on and so forth. Most purchasers are simply not in a good position to make those kinds of evaluations. You know, you really need to be an expert in order to be able to do that. You need to have construction or engineering or some kind of technical expertise. There's all sorts of weaknesses and problems with the home inspection process that there's a lot of things that it can't catch. So what you're finding is buyers are discovering a lot of problems with their homes after they go to closing and after they move in. Some of these things they may cost four or five digit repair costs to deal with, if not six digit in some cases. Typically, the buyer gets some kind of 1 year warranty on the property. And in each state, there are different implied warranty laws. And in each contract, in each packet of warranty documents, there are different rules about how what kind of warranty coverage, how long that warranty coverage lasts, and what the buyer has to do to preserve their rights under that warranty. But for the most part, you're getting buyers who are getting one-year warranties, and unfortunately, there is this kind of backdoor sales process that goes on in many cases where the buyer is told all sorts of things during this one-year period, and if they're not careful, then they can find themselves 13, 14, 18 months out past that one-year mark, if it is 1 year. I mean, it could be any number of months or years, depending on the facts of the case. And they've been played out to the point where they can no longer take advantage of the warranty. And at that point, it can be very difficult to do much about it on a legal end. And it's just all the more reason for purchasers to read all their documents. I know that when this wasn't a construction defect case, but one thing that the purchaser from Trump stated about her case was just recommended that, you know, in hindsight, she recommended that anyone purchasing real estate to read the contract very carefully to understand what their rights are. And I think that is true not just in hotel condominiums, but in the purchase of any property, whether there's an association or whether it's free and clear of any community association, that you got to know, kind of go in with your eyes open and don't allow yourself to have other people take your warranty rights away from you by promises that may turn out to be empty. So if necessary, it may require a home inspection 6 to 8 months after you've moved in, as crazy as it might sound.
Is it fair to assume that anybody who buys a housing consumer going in and buying, whether it's a new home or a pre-existing, a pre-owned home, and they get the warranty? The warranty is written by the seller or by the company that's actually guaranteeing or selling you the warranty that they'll come in and make the repairs. Have you ever seen anything that's written with giving the housing consumer, the homeowner, the upper hand, or is it always tilted more towards the person who's actually written it? Like, for instance, the developer's writing it, and they're not going to want to come in and rebuild your house.
Well, I'm looking here in front of me a section of the Virginia Code entitled Implied Warranties on New Homes. And even if your contract or your deed and purchase of a new home has no mention of warranties anywhere in the document, there is a warranty that arises by action of law. And in every state, it's different. In Virginia, we have something that's not perfect, but it's better than nothing, and it may be better than what the warranty packet information provides. Unfortunately, it's very easy to allow warranty rights to pass you by if you aren't aware that they exist, if you aren't aware that your state may have a statute that may provide you with warranty coverage that is in addition to or exceeds what your contract documents provide. So there are different ways of getting a solution to a problem. Unfortunately, that it's very when you've chosen a builder and they've built the property, it can be very easy to accept the promises that are made as far as repairing some defects after you've moved in. And but if the the law or the warranties or the contracts don't require a builder to provide coverage beyond a certain point, then, I mean, you're kind of, you know, it's you may be out of luck because that's what was bargained for.
Your point earlier about going in, if you buy a new home, having it inspected 6 or 8 months after you've moved in, it's sort of an interesting idea. But aren't most of the defects behind the walls? You know, unless they come in and tear out the walls to go and find anything. I mean, I've seen pictures and stories, heard stories about having to take down the wall and discover that there was no insulation or that there was a big hole back there. Those are only visible. It's not a
well,
naked
I mean,
eye
you,
when you're
the
walking around.
The seller is not going to let you do destructive testing.
No,
if you're going to before you purchase the home. But if you figure out that there's a problem with your house and it's behind a sheet of drywall,
then
someone's going to have to, eventually someone's going to have to take down that piece of drywall to figure out what's going on back there. If there's a problem there.
But just to have it inspected to decide whether or not there is a problem before your warranty expires?
No, I mean, I think it would be unreasonable and a little over cautious to completely take apart the house in order to figure out to do a bunch of destructive testing when you don't have a reason to believe that there's a problem behind a wall. I mean, I don't think that would be reasonable.
All right, you know, with technology as advanced as it is, do we have things like cameras and x-rays, or is that just so prohibitively expensive just to check and see? Because if you're going to, you know, if your warranty's running out and you bought a new house and you're coming to the end of that time frame, you don't want to miss out on that because
right.
You just said you're looking at, you know, multiple thousands of dollars in some cases to repair it.
Well, I mean, there are ways of finding out if there is insulation behind a wall. There are heat-sensitive devices that can figure out if there are gaps in if there's insulation behind a wall, and you can just sometimes it's as simple as using that device and comparing different walls in the house, and it's not like it can do a snapshot from behind the wall, but there's a lot of things that can be figured out. But what you typically find in the construction and home inspection industry is that if you don't ask for something to be looked into, it probably won't be considered or looked into or estimated, or you have to kind of have your eyes open and you have to think, well, you know, there's that room upstairs that is that guest room, and it always seems a little stuffy or a little drafty more than any other room, and I've always wondered why that room just felt 5 degrees different than the other rooms. I mean, maybe there's something to be looked into there, that maybe there's something that can, you know, at least you can know for yourself what the condition of your property is. It may not require a tremendous amount of destructive testing in order to figure out why that guest room is why guests prefer not to stay in that room and they want to stay in some other room. So
there's a 1-year warranty, generally implied warranty for new construction.
Well, I mentioned 1 year because that seems to be an industry
standard,
an industry like benchmark. That of course in every state and in every contract there are different terms and there are different provisions, but 1 year seems to be for structural defects like foundations and things like that, framing, and I think that there's usually a longer time period, but 1 year is usually what you see. But I don't
So if you think there's something wrong, check it out.
Absolutely.
And make sure that you don't wait until after your warranty's over with John. Thank you so very much for joining
it's
us.
It's been a pleasure.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.